I wanted to start just by explaining what this thing called Cook It Raw is. I think it's best understood as a gathering in which usually about a dozen or so chefs, all of them very accomplished, all of them really at the sort of cutting edge of cuisine, each in his or her own way, all of them travel to a usually remote, usually rural place. And while they're there, they meet farmers and other kinds of producers. They go out and forage. They hunt sometimes. They fish. And then they take what they've found and bring it back and prepare a meal, usually one dish per chef, and always with the intention of reflecting the place where they are. The first Cook It Raw took place in 2009 in Copenhagen. That was the same year that in the fall there was this major global climate change meeting called COP15 that was supposed to take place and did take place. And because the organizers of Cook It Raw, one of whom Alessandro is here with us now, wanted to kind of reflect their awareness of what was about to happen in Copenhagen and a kind of environmental consciousness, they added a challenge to the task of preparing dinner. They instructed the chefs that they, whatever dish they made, they were not to use any energy, in any fuel in preparing it. And that was the original raw in Cook It Raw. Since then, that requirement has been relaxed. And there have been four other Cook It Raws, one in Kolio, Italy, on the border with Slovenia, one in Finnish Lapland, one in Ishikawa Prefecture in Japan, and then the last one, which was last summer, in Suwalki, Poland. All told, there have been 27 chefs who have participated, and three of them, and I would say these are part of the core group. I think, Daniel, you've been at all five, right? And you guys have been to four each. So we have three of the core group here, and I thought I would start by introducing Massimo Voltura, who is the chef and owner of Osteria Francescana in Modena, Italy, which, by the way, is currently ranked third in the world on the world's 50 best restaurant list. Among the Cook It Raw chefs, I would say that Massimo is the poet. His cooking is inspired by the ephemeral, by the sublime. He takes a memory or a piece of music or an artwork, he also collects contemporary art, and transcribes it into dishes, which, although they're still recognizably Italian, are really charged with his own imagination. These dishes often end up with evocative names, like the eel who swam up the Po River, or my favorite, my personal favorite, the potato that wanted to be a truffle. For the very first Cook It Raw, which was the first time I met Massimo, he circulated a newspaper article ahead of time because he wanted to make sure that we all got the idea behind his dish. That article quoted several scientists who were reflecting on the decimation of the seas and predicted that by 2050, the only living creatures left in the oceans would be monkfish, jellyfish, algae. Incredible. And squid, and big mutant squid, right?
And the sea, they were like gray and dark and with foamy stuff.
Yeah, and that's what he made. So his dish was made out of those ingredients, and they were swimming in this very inky black pool, or they almost looked like they had washed up in it. And he called that dish pollution. And I have to say, it was as delicious to eat as it was visually repellent, which was quite. Daniel Patterson, I would sort of tag as the philosopher of this group. At his San Francisco restaurant, Qua, which has two Michelin stars, he has really reinvented what we mean by California cuisine creating something that is much more sophisticated, much more creative, and yes, occasionally quite cerebral. He has also written trenchant opinion pieces and articles. If any of you, and I'm guessing a lot of you, have made that butter using just your KitchenAid and a roll of Saran Wrap, you have Daniel to thank for that. He wrote a great New York Times piece about that. He is someone who can tell you what the relationship between deliciousness and acidity is, or why it matters to convey a sense of place in your cooking. He's going to do that in a book that will come out this fall, yes? And that we are all looking forward to reading. I remember at the Cook It Raw that was held in Japan, he made a dish that was a tofu mousse with some flowers and sprouts, vegetables, shaved vegetables, right? Shaved vegetables and a yuzu sauce. And I, during the dinner, I was seated next to Anthony Bourdain, and I was very interested to see how Bourdain was going to react to this dish, because as some of you may know, he is not a fan of vegetarians, or really even vegetables for that matter. And yet, he loved it. And I remember what he said. He said, I can taste him thinking on the plate. Finally, David Chang. Finally, among our chefs, David Chang. I think you probably all know. I know if Massimo is the poet of this group and Daniel the philosopher, I'm sort of tempted to say that Dave is the guts of the organization. But the truth is that he's a lot more than that. You all, of course, know him as the trash-talking, perhaps, chef and owner of the Momofuku restaurants here in New York. He also has restaurants in Toronto and Sydney. He's one of the founders of the wonderful no-holds-barred food magazine, Lucky Peach. In a few minutes, I'm going to ask all of them to recount some favorite memories from Cook It Raw, but I can tell you that one of the most sort of impressive moments for me was actually the first time I met Dave, and it was at the first Cook It Raw. First on a bus going out into the woods, where I ended up having a conversation with you about transcendentalism, which you may not know was the subject of Dave's senior thesis. But then we arrived at a woods where we were all going foraging, and you know, I have to admit, you know, all I knew of Dave at this point was his reputation, which definitely preceded him. And so I was scared. I have to be honest, I was scared. But then we're in the woods, and it's this, you know, beautiful northern European scene, and the sunlight is coming through the trees, and the leaves are all dappled, and they had given us these beautiful little straw baskets. And there was Dave with his straw basket kneeling down in the woods, very delicately picking wildflowers with his scarf flipped over his neck. And you looked like a wood sprite. I don't know. But it gave me the sense that there was perhaps a lot more there than his outsized reputation. The person who brought all of these people together and made this happen is Alessandro Porcelli. He, together with his co-founder Andrea Petrini, created this thing, this gathering, Cook It Raw. He himself has a very colorful background. He's worked as a photographer in Mexico. He ran a restaurant in Ireland. He was a professional basketball player in Italy. And now he is, I would say, I guess, a culinary impresario who has a tremendous talent for bringing people together in a way to think seriously, but also in a very pleasurable, enjoyable way about what food can be and what it can mean. So those are our panelists. I thought I would start by asking each of you, as a way of sort of expanding on this very bare bones definition I gave of what Cook It Raw is, to talk about, do you have a favorite memory or story that sort of exemplifies what Cook It Raw is to each of you? Massimo, would you want to go first?
Hi, good evening, everyone. So, The memories are a lot, because Raw was just an incredible experience, and it will be, for sure. It's not just about the way of cooking. It's just about catch the light, you know, that moment in the dark, in your mind, you get it, and you put it on a plate. Because you prove yourself and your friend, and it's about share. It's about, you know each other. And one of the moments, I think, for me, was one of the most significant moments, was in Lapland. Because we arrived, they led us there after 11 hours of train, the whole night. We arrived there, and out of the blue, they show us all these ingredients. So everyone was looking at herbs, flowers, beautiful mushroom, getting this, getting that. So I was playing jokes as Italians with other Italians, with Davide Scavin. And, you know, out of the blue, I look at the products, and the only thing was left was some liver and some tongues. I said, what the hell am I going to do with that? So I got the tongue, and that was reindeer tongue. So what am I supposed to do with this stuff? So I just, in my mind, I was like, okay, the wild animal, I start thinking about that, no? And I try to think how to express at their best this kind of product. So I run upstairs, I get this thermocirculator, and I create some olive oil with some ashes to give the idea of the grill. I chop some celery, carrot, and onions, as I do when I do a bollito misto, not boil, in Italy. So, and I remember there was a Jeffrey Steingarten on my side looking at me, and was like, what the hell are you doing? And I said, I don't know. I'm gonna think about like create something from this radiant tongue. How long you gonna cook? I said, I think from the weight would be like between 45 minutes and 1 hour. The cooking was like 24 hours. So it was like, you know, is the unexpected? That was the unexpected. You know, it's like you get that piece of meat and you don't know what to expect, because it's totally different from everything you ever try. So it's about, you know, prove yourself what you can do. But most of the time, hour by hour, the reindeer tongue was raw, and totally inedible. And so I got scared. And what I did, I said, "Oh, I'm gonna do a disaster. It's gonna be a disaster tomorrow," and because you don't know what's going on. So I decide to take all the reindeer tongue with me, because you know, hour by hour, you know, doesn't get any good thing, you know. So I was always there, like, it doesn't get through this finger. And so was 11 in the evening, in the night, I decide to take everything in my bedroom. So I put the thumb, I put the vacuum circulator into my bathroom, and the water, put all the reindeer tongue into the vacuum packed into my bathroom. And, you know, I put the clock, the alarm on every single hour. So just to get the feeling. But hour after hour after hour, you know, it didn't get through. So I was just sweating, not sleeping. It was just, oh my God, what's going on here? We were like switching, me and Yoji. And then Andrea Petrino was up, so I said, Andrea, just get some, come here, let us sleep, let's do like 1 hour each one of us. So at the end, it was like 6 p.m. the day after. And wasn't ready. And it wasn't ready. It was like hard. So I said, okay, turn the heat up. And at the last, there was 7:30 supposed to be served, start the service. I turn up the heat till 75 Celsius for the last hour. Out of the blue, do you remember? You came into the room. Out of the blue, the reindeer tongue left. Relax and get so soft, but so soft like you don't even use they didn't even use the knife. No. Was just melting in a palate. So that's the way to, I think, is the story and the essence of what is raw. It's like improvise, experiment, like collaborate. It's like the way you go into your, not just foraging into your brain, foraging into the wild part of the brain and the wild part of your darkness to get that moment, that flash, you catch it and you put it into the dish.
Yeah, although I would just like to say, walking into someone's bathroom and seeing a bunch of reindeer tongues in plastic bags on the floor is a memorable sight. Yeah, that's... Daniel.
Can't believe you make me go after
Massimo. I know, really.
I think that's it. We're done. So I was going to talk a little bit about the first Rob, because it was really, in a way, the most special. And most special because it was the most surprising. I think that when you have an experience or if you taste something and it's the first time, it always has the most impact. And for me, I got an email, why don't you come to this thing? And I had no idea why I was invited. And I felt like really nervous about it. I'm like, what am I going to do with all these people? I don't know how to cook like that. I just, you know, I've been so long in a kind of an isolated kitchen. And so I said, okay, I'll come. And when I got there, I didn't know anyone. I mean, I met Dave, I think, a month before. I was super nervous. I'm like, what if Dave hates me? The whole week I've been terrible. And I mean, so I get there, and I think the thing that struck me, like right off the bat, was the incredible warmth that I felt from everyone. There was no attitude. No one was. Everyone was just so kind. And we got into the kitchen. We went and we gathered our ingredients, and we're kind of trying to figure out what we're doing. We get into the kitchen, and we're prepping, and we're talking, we're getting to know each other a little bit. We go out to dinner, and then the next day we start cooking, or not cooking, I guess. And this amazing thing happened. And right around the third or fourth course, I remember this moment, and we're in the kitchen at Noma, and we've watched like 3-4 courses go out, and I remember the moment was kind of after Massimo's dish went out. We all kind of look at each other and like, whoa, this is really special. Because dish after dish, the level was kind of the same, but everyone had such a unique way of expressing themselves that we just kind of, this just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in groups. It doesn't happen that people are so unified. It doesn't happen that everyone has such a similar underpinning of way of looking at food. And I remember at the end, there was this super magic moment where Albert Adria, who had not been in the kitchen for 6 months, he'd left El Bulli, he was making dessert, and he was making a sorbet. And because it was low energy, he made the sorbet by whisking in liquid nitrogen into his base. And I remember everyone else was done, all the dishes were gone except for the dessert. And all of the chefs were in this semicircle in the golden glow of the Noma kitchen, watching Albert Adria, who I think we can all agree maybe the greatest chef of his generation, not pastry chef, whisking like his sorbet, just kind of mesmerized. And that was like a moment I'll never forget. And so I think there's a lot of really special things about the experience, but the thing that for me was the most special was that we got there and we formed these, for whatever reason, it was the right group of people. We formed these friendships that, you know, it turns out that Dave and I ended up talking all night and drinking beer, and he didn't hate me. and you know, it created these friendships that, you know, we call each other in the middle of the night where we have a bad service, or we want encouragement or advice, or just sometimes we just want to talk to someone. That your friends are kind of scattered around the world, but they're always there and they're always ready to talk to you. That was an amazing thing, and I've never experienced anything like it before or since. And so for me, like that first one was the moment that everything kind of started.
Thanks. Dave, do you hate Daniel?
Yeah, he's totally wrong about that. I never liked you.
Damn it.
What's your story?
There's so many stories, if you start thinking about it. I'm looking at every photo I can tell you about everyone. That's Inaki, and he's foraging with a cigarette in his mouth. it was the most amazing thing. So the first one was really amazing because we've just never experienced anything like that. In Copenhagen, the first Raw. The second one was in Coolio, and that was, I thought, maybe the tightest thing, because pretty much the same group from the first one had done it, and it was like really hard. Like that was the theme of it. Winter was hard.
Winter was hard, yeah.
And it was tough to cook. There wasn't like literally nothing to make food with, but the food was just
January,
really
right?
good. Yeah. I was really surprised. Like wow.
The second was the best.
Yeah. In terms of the quality of food. And people were helping each other out. It was just like this pop-up amazing restaurant, like the best pop-up of all time. And the third one, I feel that Alessandro and Andrea had this idea that, you know what, the first two went so well, it's like, it's not as fun, you guys are seasoned pros, this is easy for you, this is all about improvisation. And then they kept on saying Ornette Coleman. I'm like, what are you talking about? Improvise, Ornette Coleman, this is not good. I don't think any of us like to think that we improvise. We might, you know, cook off the cuff and come up with something, but you know, at the end of the day, we're all neurotic individuals that like need to have control of our thing in our space. And we're in Lapland, where again, there's not that much to work with: reindeer tongue, lichen, cloudberries. That was about it. Everyone has had like the same basket of ingredients, you know. The one thing that Massimo had touched upon in terms of service is that it's really intense still, too, though. Like, we're cooking for very, like, you know, big-time food professional critics and whatnot, and you want to deliver. And more importantly, nobody wants to have the worst dish. For me, it was always like, I just don't want to have the... I'm not shooting for the best. I just don't want to be remembered to have the worst dish. So...
Oh, the truth.
I'm a witness. If he doesn't tell the truth, or goes into details.
So the third one, at Lapland, so we're in the middle of the woods. It just was total anarchy. They instead of each chef cooking by themselves, they're like, you have a partner, or you have to create a team. And while that sounds great on paper, it's a total disaster in real life. It was. I think everyone that was part of that experience can safely say that it was compared to the first two, it was just sort of chaos. And for me, I had a come to Jesus moment at Lapland. We pair up, we make like 10 courses. You know, some people are making 2 to 3 courses, and it's great. You know, it's going on, and we decide on who's going to set the menu. So we create the menu, try to create a proper service, because at the end of the day, we still have to cook. We still have to get 50 covers out of multiple dishes with front of the house that have never made the food before. We've never made this stuff. We don't know how it's going to come out. And
in the kitchen, we can describe it as rustic.
Rustic. There's a big fire pit. There was one fire pit in a kitchen in the back.
There was a six burner, and there was also that big flat thing that we made the salmon on for lunch.
Yeah, yeah. That was tough.
Don't make it sound so bad, guys. Come on.
No, I mean, but so we're going over courses. Everyone has their thing, and all I remember is Albert was like, "I don't want to do dessert." So he doesn't do dessert. Was that the one?
No, he did dessert. No, he did dessert.
But we decided the second course. I only know is I'm paired up with Davide Scavini, Combo Zero in Italy, an amazing restaurant, a mad genius chef who, after the first couple raws, I was like, this guy is amazing because he's like sandbagging everything. And sandbagging is like a bad term to be called, but if you're like, what should I say? The better sandbagger you are, and if people don't know that you're a sandbagger and you're sneaky about it, it's like the highest honor you can praise somebody. And I was like, oh man.
You gotta give him a description of sandbagging.
Sandbagging is making your food before it's done, and you're done with your mise en place. You have nothing to worry about. Like, you have a bulletproof dish. It's going to go out. And that's what he had. You don't even know how it's done. It just gets done. And that's the magic behind it. And the first one, Scavini did like this crazy tendon.
1,000-year.
The tendon tartar with the cinnamon stick.
And he did it with a surgical knife, and he served it on a cinnamon stick with caviar. I was like, I don't know how he did it, but all I know is I never saw Davide do any work.
He came super late.
He came super late, and he was done. I was like, this guy knows how to do it. And the second one, similar, like just very clean, perfect, ready to go. Third one, pairing up partners, and they're like, David, we're going to pair you up with David. And I was like, yes. I'm going to learn from the master.
Find your money.
So he's like, and we get stuck with the fish course. And there's beautiful trout there. And I'm like, okay, chef, like, what do you want to do? I defer to him as chef because he's older. He's just done so much great things. And he's like, let's cook in a fire pit. I'm like, it's like 4 o'clock. It was like maybe 2 o'clock. I'm like, I know in my head, I've done it a few times. Like, you got to get those charcoals, like the wood embers, like.
And let's be clear, when you say fire pit, you mean dig a hole.
I didn't come to Lapland to fucking cook in a goddamn kitchen. I wanted to cook in be a man. I'm like, why do I get this version of Davide? Like, mountain man who wants to do everything like as hard as possible. I'm like, oh my lord. So Davide was like, okay. To make the compromise, I was like, we're going to make two dishes. So the second course is going to be two dishes just as backup. I'm going to make this trout dish. We're going to slow poach it. We're going to smoke it and a bunch of, herbs and berries or whatever. And reindeer milk. I remember reindeer milk. It was like the most expensive thing.
You made like a forest dashi with the reindeer milk.
Yes, that was it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He wanted to taste how to make a real dashi.
And then you kind of blocked it out.
I blocked it out. And Davide's there. He's still not there. And like, worth getting everything ready for a big service, Davide is taking a shuffle out. He shows up like 4 o'clock. Like, dinner starts at
five, maybe four or five.
Dinner starts at like 7:30. At this point, I'm like, Davide, I would help you dig this, but I have to make our backup dish in case this doesn't work. And he's still digging. And he doesn't start the fire till like 8 o'clock. And his goal was to just, roast fish whole buried in the earth, and
Where is Davide?
They see me freaking out because I'm like, all right, this has to go out together. Davide's fire just gets started, and like the first courses are dropped, and the kitchen is say 200 yards away from where Davide's cooking. So I'm literally doing wind sprints back and forth, checking on Davide, and I come back. I'm like, guys, we have to change the order. Davide's not ready. Second course, we get down to third course, fourth course, fifth course. And by that time, it's really cold. It's probably around like 30, just around freezing. And in that area of Sweden, there's just like outdoor saunas like everywhere. And that's where we were smoking our fish. And so Davide finally is like, I did it. We got the fish there. It's in the earth. It's cooking. I'm like, I'm just like hopeful. I'm just thankful that we have our secondary dishta. Yeah. And we did collaborate on that. And David wanted to parade the fish out on these wooden branches. It was a real spectacle. It was beautiful. But the problem was it got very cold at night. And Davide brought his wife. And
may I leave?
You know, all I'm going to say is...
He wasn't there to cook.
He wasn't there to cook. So I come back and like we're all helping each other plate, and we're like, I'm like, okay, I'm trying to figure out when we're going to get our fish course out, because now it's like getting close to dessert. It's now like 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours, and I'm just freaking out. They're all trying to calm me down, and then Ryan Miller, who worked with me, who works with us, comes in. And he's like, hey, Dave, I don't know what's going on in the smokehouse. I'm gonna check him out. So I run out there, and all I see is Davide and his wife. I don't know what they were, you know, they were just underneath fur blankets by this roaring fire. Just fire you can see from outer space. And on a pulley system above the fire, because Asana, you know, you want to utilize the fuels and cooking techniques as much as possible. Like, that's how they cooked a bunch of food in this hut. And I had put all of the fish carefully portioned out at the top, the pinnacle of this hut, which is maybe like 15, 20 feet above. But that's how high the flames were reaching, too. Nobody, he didn't even know it was there. Anyway, I brought it down, and it just totally hammered. And we're about to go into, like, meat course, and I'm like, what are we going to do? Davide, your fish is totally, like, it's still in, like, 3 feet underground, and we don't have a dish. And I was not happy at all.
And this is like course eight, right?
No. Yeah. Yoji, the guy, because I have to leave to go in another place, so I serve my course with Pascal Barbeau the day before. So Yoji, my assistant, he stayed there and he called me and said, Max, you know, Dave wants to kill David Escabir.
He comes in. He is just pale white, and he just kind of looks across the kitchen and says, "I need more fish." So the funny thing is, I end up cutting the fish, but Narasawa is like watching me cut the fish, and he's like, "Do you need some help?"
And that was the beautiful thing, is everybody realized the situation. Maybe I was just annoying everybody. I felt like I was on some reality show. This was just not funny. But that was when things got sort of beautiful, because everybody stopped what they were doing and they just started breaking down fish. And I didn't even know where the fish was coming from, but I was like, okay, we're still going to make this happen. With the help of everybody, it happened. And the dish came out, and lo and behold, David came like maybe 15 minutes later with like dirt all over him and a fish on his back. Like it was like, you know, serving it in like Caesar or Rome. I have no idea, but it was crazy. And that to me was the memory. It was like the just insane pressure. I think I was the first person to just lose my temper completely at any Cook It Raw. Really set the weird tone. And a lot of the dishes got it wasn't perfect, and that was the thing. You had all these great chefs, and because of the improvisation, we failed. And it was a failure of a dinner, but everyone helped out everybody, and we were all bittersweet about the whole process, I thought, because that's when I looked at everyone and I was like, oh, nobody's happy. We all wish it was better, and we wish that the diners had a better dinner. And I think that the food was perfectly fine, but our level of expectation for delivering was I think what is the common bond that we all have is, you know, we all want to do the best thing possible. And, you know, without their help, it would never have happened. I couldn't have gone out there without a dish. And, you know, Davide, I was mad that night, but like he couldn't have been more apologetic, and he's the man. So like
that is the man who like gives your credit card and make mojito with the credit card. Mojito for everyone.
Another that was an epic party after the first one. Davide Scavini is mixing mojitos with his credit card, shirtless, I think.
Who's going to pay? Here's the credit card.
Anyway, that's my story, and I thought that, through that failure, it actually brought the group much closer.
Okay. Alessandro, I don't know if you want to add a story, but also, you know, this... Yep. What's your idea? And so I'd be interested to know.
More or less, because this is the reason why I started to do Cookie Drama. Also, I find it very ironic actually to be here today in the public in a public library, because this is actually how I self educate myself. Because when I was 15, I used to have been kicked out of school, and I remember my mother was very worried about me. So what are you going to do when you want to be as when you grow up? And I told her, without knowing what I was saying, and this is what I end up doing, I want to travel and I want to learn languages and culture. So this was 35 years ago, more. And I find it ironic being here today, because actually this is where I spend most of my time. Instead of going to school, I was going to the public libraries and I just read. And I remember being very interested in James Joyce, because also the link, he lived in Trieste for many years, and about the epiphanies. Actually, Cookie Drama started as an epiphany, because when I was working on the idea, I had some months, because I at the time I was actually working for the Danish government. We were working out on a study on how to promote Denmark as a gastronomical destination abroad, and the COP15 was coming up. And I wanted to come up with something that was very smart and was actually depicting what we were trying to achieve. And after months and months of thinking and trying to figure out what I wanted to do and how to describe it, I went for an afternoon nap. And when I woke up, I had it. It was like cook it raw, cook it clean. And this is how I approached the government. They said, this is a fantastic idea. And why don't we try to do it? Why don't we organize an event? And but there weren't really, it wasn't very clear about what raw said. So what it was about raw, just about raw food, so not uncooked. No, I said raw as a meditation of nature, raw in English has many different meanings. So I said, why don't we try to use raw as a meditation of nature, but also as a way to look into the future of gastronomy? And that's when we called all the guys and we gave them the task of cooking without using electricity. You know, it's been an incredible journey, and I think we all learn a lot from each other from these experiences. So for me, this is what basically has been all about it: try to create this kind of a cultural bridge between the urban chefs and the rural people that we met in all of our journey. And, it started kind of, from day one, I didn't want to call it an event, because I didn't feel it was just an event in itself. It wasn't a food event. It was something that was much deeper. And it took many, many years to actually realize what we were trying to achieve with this. Because I wasn't satisfied only of having a bunch of guys having fun in the middle of nowhere. And it was much more about the learning process behind this. Also, historically, it was a very important moment because, the kitchen were becoming much more open. You know, before, for many of you probably don't know, but, there were each chef in the kitchen was like a king of his own castle. It was nothing to share about it. They were very extremely protective about the recipes, about the methods of cooking. And since the invention of these food conferences, basically starting in the early 2000s, chefs were getting together. They were actually talking. They were becoming friends. And they were doing some demos on this conference. But what struck me, because I started to follow and participate to these conferences, it was how detached was the whole thing from actual food. You know, you would see the chefs on stage cooking, but it was so far away, so detached from the public that you couldn't smell the food, you couldn't taste the food. What was very interesting was happening behind the scenes. You know, these guys getting together, having fun, sharing ideas, and build up a strong community of like-minded chefs. And this is, I had the occasion of doing an event in which I wanted to keep the intimacy that I found in the behind the scene of these conferences, but give it a strong meaning. So this is how Cook It Raw evolved and developed. So that's why each time we gave a team, and we wanted this gentleman to think more about it. We wanted to give them a tool, a platform where they could play with it and learn from each other and share knowledge. It created this arena where they could share information and learn from each other. And this is what I think has been the greatest part. And also, talking about the first Cook It Raw for me was very important because one thing about this event and the intimacy of this event was the energy that was coming out from being together with this gentleman. You know, this intangible experience, because you can't really explain about the energy that was coming out of these gatherings. You know, seeing the energy and the refreshment in these guys after following in the restaurants and the way that they were starting to connect to one another, for me was one of the drive for continuing in doing this event. So,
well, can I ask you guys? I mean, you know, as Alessandro just mentioned, you know, I think everyone in a traditional kitchen has this. To me, you know, restaurants have always sort of been like the last bastion of the guild system, and you know, there's the hierarchy. You have apprentices coming in when they're very young, sometimes you know, still in their teens, and then working their way up until they're considered masters enough to open their own restaurant. But the thing that had been lacking that you used to have in the 19th and early 20th century with the guild system was the social aspect, and you guys have all sort of referred to it. But what was that like, suddenly, you know, being in this position, you know, sort of coming from a background where things were kept close to the vest and you didn't necessarily share your recipes or share your techniques, and being in a place where all of a sudden it was almost, it was safe to do it. What was that like?
It's very challenging, but the whole scene was changing since the Congress. They start taking over with Madrid Fusion, L'Omero della Gastronomia, when Ferran Adrià is that I think is one of the is a genius. And he starts sharing all the results of the laboratory and experience and experimental he was doing. I didn't care about the idea of learning technique. I really care about what Ferran was telling us and was just free to express yourself with your mind. That was a very important moment, I think. And so through that, the recipes they start a different, became different things. You know, they can be stories, they can be social gestures. Mm-hmm. There are so many examples. For me, like for example, the eel swimming out the Po River is just a photograph of the Stensi family that in the late 16th century. They lost the incoming from the fishing of the eel from the Pope. And so they were broke, and they moved the capital from Ferrara to Modena. And that's the movement and the journey from Ferrara to Modena, passing through Veneto, passing through Mantova, coming down in the country of Modena, arriving in the canal of Modena. So it's like polenta, wild apple, saba sauce, arrive in the canal, Canal Chiaro, there is Osteria Francescana, so the eel get lacked with saba, extraction of apple and creamy polenta. Or like the the risotto cacio e pepe that I did for the the earthquake victim of the earthquake in Modena, try to help the Parmigiano Reggiano to sell 400,000 big wheels broken or damaged. So these kind of things, or pollution, as we were talking, no, is the recipes. There are no more recipes. There are ideas, and as we were talking before, in an interview, came out something from my mind that I don't know why, but I was expressing. I was trying to understand why, as an outing, you know, in front of a camera. And I remember in 1993, I was in Louis XV in Hotel de Paris, working with Alain Ducasse, and after I was finishing my internship, ready to go, I met the chef in the middle of the hotel. And he was asking me questions like this, and said, "So, how was that? A beautiful chef. It was incredible. You know, I get sick so many hours to work, and that was incredible from the chocolate. Do you get notes?" "Yes, of course I get the whole book of notes. Unbelievable. Can I see it?" So I saw Ducasse get my book, and you know, in front of me, he did like this, and he threw into the garbage, and he was like, "What are you doing?" "What are you doing?" It's like, you're ready to walk, to stand up on your feet, and to walk with your life. If you learn, it's about that. It's about learning ideas. Because, you know, technique, you can go in the best place in Japan or to learn how to cut fish, or in France to make a sauce, or in Italy to roll a pasta. But it's about this. It's about the idea. The idea that, you know, you have to grow here. Ideas are the most important thing, and draw was the way to explore into your brain, into the dark part of your brain, and get the flash for that idea.
But in a collective way, I mean, all of you were doing the same thing at once, yes? I mean, did that give you the kind of security to go into that dark
place?
Yeah,
but everyone to a greater or lesser degree, so... some people came in, like Dave said, more prepared, some people less, some events more,
and
some
Yaki
events less.
But,
you know, but, you know, I think that the whole idea about recipes, and this has come up before about the book, there's no recipes in the book, and I think the whole idea about recipes is that, you know, the what we were doing was more about intuition, and it's about kind of going back to what it means to be a cook. What it means to be a cook is someone hands you something you've never seen before, but you've seen something like it, but you've seen 10,000 things like it, not one thing, but 10,000, you know, and then you're looking at it going, well, it kind of looks like this, and maybe I can do that. And so, like the reindeer tongue, it wasn't the first time you ever cooked a piece of meat. You've cooked thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of meat, so you get this idea, okay, I'm going to do this at this temperature because that should work. It doesn't work, and then all of a sudden you have a trigger. Now I have to do this. I have to do it because, I have to serve it. But then in that moment, like you say, that flash of brightness, that is where there's an advance. So the sandbagging happens because you've had these flashes, these moments where you've just leapt. And the ability to fail, I think, is central, actually, to the Cook It Raw, because we can't fail in our restaurants. I can't fail in a dish when someone comes in and they're paying a lot of money. And so we go to these places with our friends. Yeah, it's a lot of writers and it's a lot of pressure, but at the same time, there we can do things that we could never do in our own restaurant. And we show up just like your product's not there. It's not what it should be. You look at your oven and you're like, Jesus Christ. Like when I was at when I was in Finland, I cooked in the stove because I saw, like, we couldn't even fit everyone in the kitchen. It was so tiny. And so, like, I cooked everything in a stove, like, and Claude Bozy was like...
No, in a fireplace.
In the fireplace, excuse me. Mm-hmm. This massive fireplace. And I put some beets in and I threw it on the floor in a container. And Claude Bozy is looking at me going, so how about I make you a bet? We trade dinner, first class plane ticket, and hotel accommodations. Those aren't going to be ready in 6 hours. I'm like, come on, of course they're going to be ready. I come back in an hour, and it's the same thing like the reindeer. I'm like poking. kind of looking at him, and I poke the beets, and I'm like, oh my God, you're so right. And so I dump them on the floor, I build this massive fire, and it turns out they were cooked, and not only cooked, but amazing, you know? And so some of the discoveries you make are a product of putting yourself in a position to fail, or and sometimes you do fail, and sometimes you don't fail, but those moments where you don't fail is everything, because that's where you develop the understanding that allows you to not fail consistently.
But you know why? Sorry. You know why? Because I realize now when you were talking, it's just because we are not in an everyday life. You know, we are not filled of obsession. In those moments, you know, obsession, obligation, the things I have to go to the counter, the bank, pay this, pay there, oh, that doesn't work. In those moments, we leave that space for the poetry free. So we leave that space and we jump into the poetry and we create something like that. I think that is the moment. And this is the secret of life.
Okay. Yeah.
I did something.
So that's I guess.
Yeah, we can end right there. Dave, you talked about failure too. I mean, do you find in those situations that it made you more creative or did it just like totally stress you out?
May I kiss him?
Yeah. Yes, you may.
Please.
He clearly needs one.
It's definitely stress. I was thinking about the first time when I was at the first one at Noma, and I walk into the kitchen, and Albert Adria, Daniel had mentioned this, had retired. He was like 6 or 9 months, and he's like, I'm on the same plane with him, and the only thing he was talking about was Barca, the soccer team. And then all of a sudden we land, he's like, okay, I gotta go to the kitchen. I'm like, and he puts on his whites, he's like, David, this is the first time I've put on whites in 9 months. And I'm like, okay, I didn't really understood what it meant. And then he wanted to get to the kitchen, and again, like, he's the man, he's the dude, all right? Ferran is Ferran, but Albert may be the best cook of all time. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm sitting next to him on an airplane. Then I'm like, okay, we're entering the kitchen together. Then he's putting on his whites and he's telling me stuff I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. And then I see him and he's immediately trying to make that sorbet ice cream. And for the next 24 hours, he didn't sleep. He just kept on failing over and over and over again. He must have gone through maybe 1,000 eggs making the base.
Yeah.
And it was pretty insane to watch this guy just... He had like two assistants next to him, and he's making a canal onto like the stainless steel plate on just the table, just trying to envision how the dish is going to work, and then taking a bench scraper and throwing it in the trash over and over. I was like, that's the secret. There's no geniuses. It's just how many failures they're going to make.
Yeah.
And for Albert, he made all the failures before that final moment, which was totally beautiful. And on the other hand, like, you see so many different personalities. And for someone like Inaki, the chef at Chateaubriand, who, you know, coaxes flavors that you just don't think exist because of the fact that he wasn't trained. He didn't work for Ducasse. He has just like this Jimi Hendrix-like figure that can make food just so delicious. And there he is in the kitchen. He's next to Pascal Barbeau, who's just a ninja, and he's making this amazing dish. And I see him puree button mushrooms with eel dashi, and he's got frangelica. I'm like, what the hell's frangelica? And he's teaching me. And he's, you know, he's the first person I ever saw to use a Japanese technique with French flavor. It was usually vice versa. Yeah. And then you see that, and I'm like, okay, I don't even understand what's going on. It's so simple.
And then to add to the cognitive dissonance, he's like a happy ninja.
Yeah, and he's jumping
around. Bouncing around.
Yeah.
And it's
so
like, do you need
happy.
Any help? No. And he produces, like, easily three times the work that any human should be able to produce.
And pound for pound, you will say, like, pound for pound, he's easily one of the best chefs. Nobody will ever talk poorly about this guy.
Yeah.
And then you see Inaki, who's just chilling. Because he doesn't even know what he's doing.
And he's stoned at the
That's
same time.
Just, and I don't mean that. Like he's the natural. Yes, and right. I'm like, oh my God, here I am. Everyone's sort of freaking out, with the exception of maybe Pascal and Inaki. And he takes the trash. I mean, literally, Pascal was about to throw away this button mushroom mixture with eel.
Yeah.
And Inaki's like, no, I want that. And then he's like, oh, you got lobsters? Great. And he's like, oh, yeah, get some that squab liver. I did order squab liver. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, he's going to eat. And I had to watch him because I've had his food before, but now you get to work with him. And you get to see sort of the brilliance behind the food. And his cooking technique, I was like, what is he doing? He's taking the lobster, and he's like, they're like raw, but he's infusing it in the cryovac machine. Then all of a sudden, I just see like 25 stages just microplaning Sicilian pistachios. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And then he's taking the orange rinds, and he's like, okay, he has all of these crazy elements, but he made a consomme out of Pascal's mushroom puree. He had infused the lobster with like, I can't remember, like the citrus thing, so it was like actually cooked. And he made this rare squab liver puree with a beautiful schmear, and he dusted it, made all the pistachio, shaved pistachio with Maldon salt, and mixed it with the orange zest. And, you know, made like a sorrel oil. Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful. And I'm like, what? I just couldn't understand what was going on. I was like, how did this happen? How did he have maybe the most beautiful dish, the best tasting dish, and he didn't do anything until like 2 hours before dinner? I was totally shocked. I was like, this guy is on another planet.
Oh man, I did a dinner with him. Like, we were each doing four courses in Portland. It was crazy. So imagine that, but with four times as many courses. And it was... the food was so good. We had the best time. And it's like, the thing is, like, but it is a lot about, like, the way he works is very intuitive. And he couldn't get a Paco Jet. Apparently in Portland, there's only one Paco Jet, and someone else was using it at the time. So he was making, like, this incredible sauce, which is like a ceviche. And he usually puts it into a Paco Jet, and it becomes kind of a snow. So he makes a ceviche and gets rid of everything but keeps the juice. And so we showed him like how we make ice at the restaurant, and just kind of forking it and whatever. And he liked it so much that he ended up changing the whole dish. And then what came out of it, like when everything came together, was so good. But half of it was improvised like 5 hours before we actually did the dinner. And so I think that's, you know, like style-wise, that's like, that was the great thing about... Yeah, I mean, you know that you, like, I spent 2 weeks talking to Inaki before we were going to have... So now tell me exactly what you want, and I'm going to order everything for you, and I'm going to have a lot, and you can just kind of do... And he just shows up, and all of a sudden, it's great food. But everyone's different.
Yeah. Well, I remember talking to Rene Redzepi, the chef at NoMa, about, you know, how he saw the significance of Cook It Raw. And I remember he said, it made me feel less... insecure. It made me feel, and you mentioned this about the sort of like minds. Do you guys feel like you're a movement
no,
at
I
this
still
point?
Still feel insecure.
Okay, still feel insecure. Yeah. But I mean, has it given you a different sort of sense of yourself and this group within the world of cuisine?
I think you get to see just how crazy everybody is. Really, in the private moment, you get to see just how crazy everyone is. Everyone still has the insecurities. And then you get to see, like, people, like the first one, like, no one really knew what was happening. And Rene, you brought Rene up, and his dish was just the bulrush, like the second growing of a leek. He's like, dude, I'm just going to serve this. Like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm just going to cut off the stem and give him a whole, this thing that's like, just this bush. And I'm like, you're fucking crazy, man. Like,
right. Wait, like, wait, but what was the other thing he served? He brought the live shrimp.
There's fjord shrimp, they're fresh water, and they're beautiful. And he's like, I'm just going to serve it like this. It's raw. I'm like, you got some cojones, man. Like, you are crazy. Yeah. Totally crazy.
Well, we're saying this as we're sitting around, like, looking at him. He's like, try it. And we're just like, okay.
Right.
You know, and then it wriggles around in your mouth before you... actually write down.
Yeah. And he's like, he pulls this thing out of the ground and he peels it and he's like, eat it. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing, man?
Right.
And it tasted like a cucumber heart of palm. And, and like, that sort of set the tone, and you just see just how sort of crazy everybody is. Like, he had to build up that courage to do it. And I think that's what everyone sort of helps. It's like Claude Bossy is notorious for his one-liners. But it's very instructive. He was probably telling... You know, Claude doesn't like to tell everybody just how much he knows about food, but there's probably about three chefs in the world that worked at Arpège when there were two stars getting three stars. And we had two of them, Pascal Barbeau and Claude Bossy. Between the two of them, they know more about food than, you know, intuitive cooking than just about anybody else. And, you know, Claude walks by and he makes fun of Daniel, like, ha ha, those beats are never going to be done. But that's how Claude's way of telling Daniel, like, hey, man, I've done this before. Right. You might want to listen up. And
right. Well, it's also his way of just busting my balls.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's the biggest
that
thing.
He was aiding you.
Two is all we do is make fun of each other. I think in any kitchen, that's like the sign of a very healthy kitchen, how much humor is being thrown around. And almost instantaneously, everyone's making fun of each other. Yeah. All the time.
But you know, to answer like kind of the heart of your question, if any one of us called anyone else and said, I really need something, we would be on a plane like instantly. And so that kind of relationship is very rare. And I feel like, so yeah, we're getting in a kitchen and we're going to poke fun of each other. But at the end of the day, if you need anything, like everyone's there for each other. And that's pretty amazing. And so yeah. The kind of confidence you get out of that, it's not like an everyday confidence. It's more like a humanity confidence. Like it's hard, you know, being a chef now. It's like I can't think of any other profession in the world where everyone pokes and prods and you know, if you imagine like, you know, an accountant, someone sitting there every hour of the day saying, well, I just saw you you added those numbers wrong, and by the way, I think you overbilled that client, and I'm just going to go online. And you know, so in the world of what it means to be a chef now versus what it meant when we started cooking, when actually all we did was cook, you know, I think it gives a little bit of, I don't know, we can call each other up and share our craziness.
Okay, but let's start, I mean, the flip side of that, and I have, is some of the criticism that Cook It Raw has received. One critic called it a Boy Scout camping trip for adult chefs.
Was that a criticism? Are you sure?
Then one of my colleagues from Time said, but the more they hang out with each other, the less they are actually cooking or bothering about what people actually want to eat. How do you guys respond to that kind of criticism?
I wake up in the morning, I'm going to bed in the night, in the meantime, I do what I want to do. That's it.
Okay. Nothing to add either of you to that.
I mean, listen, everything can be criticized. And it's an easy target to criticize this. Absolutely. It really only benefits, you know, in the immediate, in the now, like a handful of people. But I think that, you know, as we go around, like, these ideas get spread faster and more meaningfully than just online or reading it. You know, you can tell a cook, you know, just, you know, how many kids go through your kitchen now, and, like, they can yeah. share that experience, and it gets passed down. And those are the stories. Like, before things were online, I remember, like, hearing about this guy in Spain, and they're like, oh, you can eat cold and hot soup. I'm like, what the hell? Why would you want to do that? That's not, I can't even imagine what it was like. But, you know, or people coming back from France and they're like, hey, like, you know, Gagnère cooks it this way. And now that's all online. You can find every photo, you can find everything online, and there's no more magic, there's no more storytelling. And I think that for Cook It Raw at the very least, and I'm the most pessimistic person, but this group of guys and girls, and just the journalists as well, it allows everyone to sort of share the stories, and that gets passed through the kitchens as well.
Hmm. Well, this might be a good chance to ask what's yeah. next for Cook It Raw.
I mean, I just would like to add, for me also, I mean, you started saying, I mean, I'm a basketball player. Both of my parents were professional basketball players, and they play for the Italian national team, so this is how I was brought up. I mean, for me to see this, being here today, and see how these guys are talking passionate about being together and sharing and being inspired by one another. For me, this is actually what I would like to, you know, for me actually doing the book, it made me realize what we've been trying to do from day one. That's why, I mean, about tweeting, and it started only very recently. Working on this book, it's made me realize what we want to do in the future. For me, one of the most important aspects is to try to transmit the spirit of Cuquitrol, you know, what you experience here today, you know, getting a group of people to inspire one another. Just can happen in the world of food, but also outside the world of food. This is what, for me, is also intriguing about creating a gathering like this, because it's like planting a seed in people's mind and how to see how that seed grows, you know, and that we were fortunate enough that to have done a quite an interesting job in maintaining this intimacy in the group, which is fundamental for me. So the future of Cuquitrol. Now we are planning to do something with the Sean Brock in South Carolina. And we want to spend there a week. Actually, I want to go there and spend 2 months. I want to bring my family. I want to build a strong team spirit, because this is what also with Cuquitrol, what has helped me is basically to work and create my own lifestyle. This is why I feel extremely fortunate of doing this, but also to create like some interesting content, more content. It's not just about inspiring, but also go more into the culture of the area where we are visiting, engage more with the local people. So this build an even stronger cultural bridge that I mentioned before. This for me is the most important aspect, especially nowadays. I think we need something like this, and that's what is my main drive, is to see just an idea, an epiphany, as I said before, to grow into an idea. It can be a movement or whatever, but it just makes people think, you know, we are here today. You know, you came to listen to us. You know, people buying a cookbook with no recipes. You know, as Massimo very emphatically did by breaking his paper, this is what it is. It's not about recipe anymore. It's about thinking about what you're doing, you know, what you have in your local food store, and it's about improvising. And so this is what is Cuquitrol. It's about inspiring each other, and as a trickle down effect, is to inspire also people to start to think about food in also in a playful but also in a much more serious manner. So this is what we would like to do also in the future, to build a stronger content and to delve more also into the various aspects of food. So what's best place than the Low Cuisine in South Carolina?
South Carolina, perfect. We're
No, I like because it's like, and maybe we can get a bus and go through. I love it. You know, it's like we're going on Route 66, and we're going to tweet, and we're going to tweet. Tonight we're going to in Winslow, Arizona.
Maybe, good.
I don't know, you know, I said, I have the dish for like that South.
You have an the Italian, dish for Winslow, Arizona?
An Italian that goes in South Carolina is going to make pizza barbecue.
Now you said it.
You're committed.
Well, I'm gonna do it.
Well, we're just about out of time. So, just as the last question, what is it? I mean, what is it that you've sort of taken back to your own kitchens from these different experiences? And by that, I mean, at the very broad sort of philosophical level, down to the very specific dish level or relationship level. What stands out as like the thing, how have you changed as a result of this experience or experiences?
For me, it's like, as I said before, and I realized before, it's like the way you don't have to lose yourself in everyday life. You have to find that way, that way, that spirit that comes from the raw. And every time I bring one different with me, like Davide, Yoji, Taka, and you know, to share this experience, and you know, to me, I think it's like so changed so much the way you approach to the cuisine. You go deep, and you realize how lucky you are to do a job like this, to express so much of yourself, to express so much of your passion, of your culture. For me, it's the music, the art, and the cooking. They are one thing.
It's not that, you know, now it's time to cook, then listen to some music, and then now I'm all, oh yeah, that's beautiful painting. Or, no, it's just the life of yourself. So humility to learn from other, passion to explode into the beauty of what you do, and the dream means future. So what I'm bringing, more future.
Okay, Daniel.
Well, I was thinking about what you're saying about the Boy Scouts, and in a way, like, I think one thing that we all kind of share, I think you're right. There's, I mean, in a way, there's no particular relevance to 10 people who go and they cook a few things and they go back. This is a world of billions of people and whatever, and you know, it's insignificant in a way. But for us, or for me, being able to retain that kind of childlike sense of wonder, you say Boy Scouts, I think, well, in a way, to go back, to remember. So our everyday life, we're actually pretty responsible, you know? We run businesses, and we pay employees, and we pay our taxes, and we do a lot of stuff, you know? We kind of matriculate more or less like normal people, and we go, and to be able to stay connected to this sense of discovery, which is so primary to being able to create anything, and to take that back, and for me also to be inspired. Like, I go and I see what Dave's doing, I see what Massimo's doing, and I go back, I'm like, damn it, you guys, we're not doing enough, we have to work harder, you know? And going back and telling, like, you know, sometimes guys travel with us, sometimes they don't, but we always go back and tell them. We tell them, hey, you wouldn't believe this thing that I saw Pascal do. Albert, oh my God, he did this thing with caramelized sesame seeds. It was like God reached down and individually separated them. I don't know what he did, but... You know, and so these moments of wonder that we're bringing back to our kitchen, it's like you can't put any kind of value on it. It's everything. And so a cook, mostly our jobs are pretty much drudgery, and with these occasional moments that are so extraordinary that you kind of trudge along waiting for that one moment that is so great that you just kind of want to discover it again. Yeah. Well, I had an interview and they compared creativity to crack, and I thought that was pretty apt.
Dave?
I think the one thing you take away the most is, like, besides, like, sort of just being a fan, you know, it's hard to stay completely enthusiastic all the time about food because of the drudgery and all the nonsense. But then when you get to see, like, the best, and you just, it's a humbling experience to look in a room. There's Massimo, there's Daniel, there's Alex Atala, there's Claude Bossi, there's Pascal Barbeau, René Redzepi. You're just like, whoa, what the hell am I doing here? And these are the guys that, not just the food that I want to eat, you just want to get just a piece of the moment. And it's like being a fan of a sports team or a band or something, and you get to actually be a participant member. And I think at the end of the day, it's just I think what you take away is nostalgia. That there is, no matter how bad things are, it's like, oh yeah, that was sort of awesome. So.
Okay. Well, I hope all of you will take away the same sentiment, that this was kind of awesome. Thank you for coming.